Good morning and welcome to True Talk. This is your host, Samar Jarrah. I'm going to be talking with Professor Khalid Mustafa Midani. He is in Canada at the moment, but he is chair of the African Studies Program at McGill University. He's the author of Black Markets and Militants, Informal Networks in the Middle East and Africa. I'm going to be asking about this book later on the show, but we want to discuss Sudan. A lot of things are going on there, and I think it's very important that we talk about it. Good morning, Professor. Can you hear me?
Yes, good morning. Thank you for having me on your show today.
It's a pleasure. And Professor, I just found you on Twitter and I just tweeted that your students and your followers can actually listen live on WMNF via the website I just sent and tweeted. I hope you paid attention to it. I want to really start with a little bit background on Sudan. I have to admit that my co-host and myself have not discuss Sudan in depth before. So before we do, I would love for you to tell us a little bit about the country because it's quite big, much bigger than Egypt, and it has lots of people and natural resources. So could you start with that?
Yes, of course. It is one of the largest countries in the continent of Africa. It was actually the largest before 2011 when the South Sudan seceded through a referendum. But it remains a very large country, very diverse. It, of course, borders Ethiopia and Egypt and Chad and Libya, Central African Republic, Uganda to the south, and Kenya as well. So at least South Sudan does. So it's very large, about maybe over 400 different ethnic groups, very diverse. And I think that while it is in aggregate terms not as wealthy on paper, so to speak, it is really rich in natural resources, not only oil, but gold, which is Sudan has the third largest deposits of gold in the continent of Africa. It borders, of course, the Red Sea, which is a very important port, not only for Sudan and Egypt, but the entire Indian Ocean and Red Sea region. So it's also strategically placed. In that sense, it's really important. It's diverse ethnically, which is really important because even to this day, there have been really a long history of civil conflicts where insurgent organizations, particularly in the western part in Darfur that your listeners may have heard of, but also on the borders along the border of South Sudan, there's a strong insurgency there. And also in southern Kordofan, which is one of the southern states in Sudan. So there have been three ethnically based insurgent organizations that historically have also taken up arms against the central state. It's an Arab-speaking country primarily, but we do have a variety of different local languages as well. Arabic happens to be the official language. Its diversity is very important. And that point, of course, is important because the revolution that occurred in December 19, 2018, that began in that late 2018, really for the first time brought all of these ethnic groups, all of these language groups, together to oust the former dictator Omar Bashir. So it's one of the reasons that so many people, not only inside Sudan, but outside of Sudan, really were awestruck to see such unanimous opposition to authoritarianism, especially given the diversity of the country.
I'm going to go back to that, but while researching to do this, and I have heard it a long time ago, that people think, of Africa, they think of famine, they think of dry lands. But actually, Sudan has lots of farming where, for instance, countries like Saudi Arabia and the Emirates have bought land and have like crops growing there and cattle growing there. Is that correct? Is it still the case?
Absolutely. It's something I'm glad you brought it up because it's one of the facts that people don't know about the country. It's fertile along the Nile, just like in Egypt, where it's, of course, irrigated by the Nile, but also rain-fed agriculture, mm-hmm. particularly in the west, in the province of Kordofan and Darfur as well, is really, really rich in terms of its soil. Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, even Qatar, particularly the Gulf countries, have huge investments in land. land, huge farms in Kordofan in particular, but also the northern state, and also increasingly in southern Kordofan as well. You'll see the way that it works in Sudan is the previous government in particular would lease land to Saudi Arabia for 99 years at very low cost. And the capital investment then would be coming from Saudi Arabia in terms of establishing these huge farms that generate crops for primarily, and this is why it's so important, controversial, primarily for export, not only to the Gulf countries, but also to Egypt, by the way, who imports large quantities of livestock and sesame seed from Sudan. So the very rich lands and natural resources are heavily invested in. The Gulf countries actually are the biggest investors in Sudan, even though people think that it's small, it's actually in the billions of dollars.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Professor, because later on when we talk about politics and maybe who is interfering in the affairs of Sudan, we can refer to some of these investors. But let me just remind our listeners, we are talking to Professor Khaled Mustafa Midani, and he is the chair of African Studies program at McGill University in Canada. We are discussing Sudan. People might not know maybe who was Omar al-Bashir. How long was he in power before, like you mentioned, towards the end of 2018 or let's say the beginning of 2019, we saw maybe we can call it an Arab Spring happening in Sudan. So what were the people in Sudan like revolting against, or what were they demanding, and who was Omar al-Bashir?
Sure. It's very important. Sudanese always like to emphasize to me that when I do these interviews, to remind people that there have been a number of different pro-democracy uprisings and revolutions. The first historical one was in October 1964 that toppled the dictator at the time, General Ibrahim Aboud. And another one that's really important was 1985 that toppled Jafar Nimeiri. There was a brief period of democracy between 1985 and 1989, similar to what happened recently in the transition period. And in the summer of 1989, an Islamist fundamentalist-backed coup led by General Omar Bashir toppled that democratic experiment, the latest democratic experiment of the 1980s. Omar Bashir, backed by the Islamists in the country that were very, very organized at the time, as you probably know and your listeners are aware, ruled Sudan in a very authoritarian fashion for 30 years. Wow. 33 decades of real brutality. And I'd like to emphasize that because it's not just repression in Khartoum, but this was a period that saw the escalation of the civil war against non-Arabs in South Sudan. Of course, it was also the period where the huge violence in the conflict in Darfur began in 2013. And of course, also in southern Kordofan in the Nuba Mountains, where scores of people were killed. The estimates are difficult to come by, but for southern Sudanese in particular, I think about over a million. Those who were killed in Darfur under this Omar Bashir regime are upwards of 200,000, with over a million displaced throughout Sudan and also across the border in Chad. And so, you know, not only do you have the kind of denial of freedoms, civil rights, but really, you know, three ongoing civil wars that were really conducted and executed by Omar Bashir and his allies in what was then the ruling National Congress Party. And this is why the revolution of December 19, 2018 becomes so important, because these young people, not only youth activists, but unions and the Sudanese Professional Association and a variety of different groups in civil society, including the political parties that also helped to organize the protest, were able to overthrow through peaceful civil disobedience 30 years of the dictatorship of Omar Bashir. And it was after that revolution in April 11th, 2019, that Omar Bashir was ousted by people in the military, including General Abdel Fattah Burhan, who's just recently on October 25th waged yet another military coup to try to end the revolution in Sudan and the pro-democracy movement.
Was it violent? Was there any violence during the 2019-2018 uprising?
Yes, there was absolutely no violence on the part of the protesters. And the reason I emphasize this is that I think that whether it's in Egypt or North Africa or the African continent or even globally, one of the really miraculous characters or the attributes of the revolution that began in 2018 was, as Sudanese like to say in Arabic, Sawratna Silmiya, our revolution is peaceful, an insistence that no form of violence against military forces or the government should be executed, and that the only power that the people have against the military is peaceful civil disobedience. Unfortunately, the military under Burhan at the time and also his deputy, General Hemeti, who is also the head of this very violent militia called the Rapid Support Forces that was responsible for many of the deaths and the killings and displacement of Darfurians in Darfur, because he was a commander in Darfur during that war, did something that Sudanese to this day continue to try to get the world's attention on for accountability. And that is what they did was they went into the sit-in where young people were holding a sit-in very similar to the one in Tahrir in Egypt, if you will remember. This one was in front of the army headquarters to try to overthrow Omar Bashir and also to elicit the support of what Sudanese activists like to say, the honorable members of the military. And what happened is on June 3rd, the military, with the militias of Hemeti and Islamist militias from the former regime, and now we know also under the oversight of Burhan himself, went into the sit-in. And they not only killed upwards of 200 people, but they sexually assaulted women. They threw bodies into the Nile River. The death rate and death toll is still difficult to come by and to be sure of because of the absence of accountability associated with those who perpetuated this huge crime. This was the biggest massacre that Khartoum itself, the capital city, had witnessed. There were many killings, of course, in throughout the protest in the past, but this one was extremely brutal. The response was really interesting in Sudan to this violence, and the response was one of a continuing peaceful civil disobedience. Interestingly enough, throughout that month, what Sudanese did was engage in peaceful civil disobedience, including strikes, work stoppages, protest in the neighborhood, and that, in conjunction with the condemnation of the international community, forced the military under Burhan's leadership to actually come to the table and form a partnership agreement with the main opposition group, the umbrella group in Sudan called the Forces of Freedom of Change, that ultimately nominated Abdullah Hamdok as prime minister for this partnership between the military and the civilians that Burhan has basically upended and overthrown with his military coup of October 25th.
I want to go back, Professor, to again the events of 2019, because I'm reading an old article, or I think an interview that you conducted, or you were the interviewee. And you mentioned that there wasn't really much international reaction, or was there an attempt to silence international community opposition to the brutal putting down of what was going on. And you do mention that part of who was backing the Janjaweed and backing Burhan was Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and United Arab Emirates. Was that correct then?
Absolutely, it was. Absolutely. Before the massacre, and this is, you know, open source, it's available in all newspapers, General Burhan went to Egypt, he visited Saudi Arabia, and he visited the United Arab Emirates only days before the massacre. So it was very clear, as it is clear now, that external actors are supportive. At that point, there was support for Burhan, full support from these actors. And by most accounts, that emboldened, General al-Burhan to action. The severity of the massacre, however, not only led to increasing condemnation on the part of the U.S. administration, but also the African Union itself. In combination with African Union's condemnation and the United States, at that period, you could see the decline of support, at least in that period, following the massacre on the part of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates in particular, although Egypt stayed silent. And it was really the mediation of the African Union in particular, not the Arab League or those Arab countries supporting Burhan at the time, that managed to put enough pressure to bring Burhan to the table. But the real pressure, of course, was the inevitable, as it is now, as Sudanese say, al-Shari, the street, without really mobilizing across the social spectrum and across regions and ethnicity. Of course, Burhan, no matter what international condemnation came from the United States or even mediation from the African Union, there would have not been pressure to even get to the point where you have a partnership between the civilians and the military at the time.
Let me remind our listeners, they can send email to dj@wmnf.org, dj@wmnf.org, and I think you can also text, but you can also, the text is 813-433-0885, and if you want to ask Professor Khalid Mustafa Medani a question, you can call 813-239-9663, 813-239-9663. The question that people ask, maybe Professor, more in the Arab world than here in the U.S., is why would the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia be so much interested in the affairs of Sudan and be siding with the military junta and with the coup? Like, what is it they are afraid of, or what is it that they want to see happening in Sudan?
Well, number one, they want a reliable ally, and historically, both for both Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, as some of your listeners may know, find civilian democracy a little bit too complicated. And also, from the Arab perspective, as all Arabs know, these are Arab countries that are very influential with each other, especially at the level of civil society. And it's hard for those who are not from the Arab region to imagine that political developments, let's say a pro-democracy movement, whether it's in Sudan or Tunisia or Egypt, it's difficult to imagine how that does not influence domestic politics in other Arab countries. It's just a historical fact. And to this day, there are, for example, Egyptians right now in Sudan who are part and parcel protesting with Sudanese in Khartoum and other areas. So that connection is very important. The beginning of the Sudanese uprisings, although they have a longer history, begin following on the heels of Tunisian Arab Spring and uprisings in Tunisia and even more so in Egypt in 2011. That kind of, you know, interrelationship is very, very important. But the other important aspects, I think, that are more important are the strategic and economic linkages. For Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, the war in Yemen, of course, was and continues to be really strategically important for their own sense of security, of course, and their relationship to Iran. And what they did during the Yemen war before Saudi Arabia has been forced essentially to try to find an exit option is to have Burhan and Hemeti basically send soldiers, Sudanese soldiers, to fight alongside the soldiers, the Gulf soldiers in Yemen. That was a clear, strategic interest for supporting not only Burhan, but Hemeti himself. That's extremely important. Another aspect is really the economic one, and this is becoming even increasingly more evident, even more than during the first revolution of 2018 and 19. And that is a real interest in the economic and natural resources. In the 1980s, late 70s and 80s, the Gulf countries had labeled Sudan the potential Arab breadbasket of the region. Yeah. But the investments now are in millions. They range from livestock to commodities, agricultural commodities such as sesame and sorghum. That becomes a really important source of imports for countries that are flush with oil, but not, of course, course, agricultural commodities, the relationship between the gold trade between Sudan and the United Arab Emirates, and particularly the Dubai markets. Over 90% of the gold in Sudan is actually is destined or exported to the markets in the United Arab Emirates. Now, the majority of that that gold is actually smuggled, and it's smuggled primarily by militia, heads of militia, including most notably the Hemeti himself, who's the deputy of Burhan. So here you see, of course, not only the political dangers of an Arab country that has a successful democratic transition that influences the entire region, not to mention the Gulf countries domestically, but also strategic interest having to do with, believe it or not, the Gulf countries' relationship to Yemen and the larger issue of Iran itself, which for the Saudi Arabians and the Emirates is crucial, a matter of almost an existential kind of strategic relationship or concern. And the other, which is less documented but completely available now, is the billions of dollars worth of investment in land and the leases in land. There's also interest in the ports of Port Sudan, particularly mm-hmm. on the part of the United Arab Emirates. And so if you bring all of these together, you'll see the interests are extremely deep. And now it's extremely well known to the majority of Sudanese, actually.
How was the reaction of the State Department and the Biden administration towards the coup that just took place in Sudan?
The initial response on the part of the Biden administration was very strong. It had to do with the fact that the special envoy, Feltman, for the Horn of Africa had gone, I believe, in October 24th or so, a day before the mm-hmm. coup, and had managed, by all accounts, to convince and persuade both Burhan and Hamdok, the prime minister, that they should continue in line with the constitutional declaration that guaranteed a transition to a civilian head of the sovereign council, essentially of the government. On November 17th, only yesterday, the constitutional declaration and the agreement, it was postponed because a couple of times, had really stipulated that Abdullah Hamdok would take over from Burhan as the head of the sovereign council, and essentially the head of government would be a civilian who then would oversee elections. The next day, General Abdel Fattah Burhan waged the coup. The immediate response on the part of the Biden administration was, of course, very strong condemnation. The same occurred with the international donors, the international financial institutions such as the World Bank and IMF, and the African Union also kicked Sudan out of its membership as a way to put pressure. The general reaction has consistently been on the part of the Biden administration is to persuade or insist on the resumption to the partnership that was stipulated in August of 2019, the constitutional declaration, and to resume the partnership and then oversee the transition to civilian rule and then elections. That's been the Biden administration's position, consistent position. But following the violence that occurred on just yesterday against the peaceful protesters, 15 who I know of at this moment have been killed under horrible circumstances, shot in the head, shot in the stomach, hundreds injured in hospitals where ambulances are prevented from actually picking up even the victims to take them to the hospital. The reaction from my perspective and many others, I think, has been very tepid. Condemnation, but no real strong condemnation in terms of sanctioning those responsible for these killings. No stronger language that so far that threatens Burhan's economic lifeline, for example, and also threatens sanctions against this coup and the coupist, those responsible for the coup. So there's been condemnation, but from the perspective of Sudanese, as you can imagine, and the region generally, there is really disappointment mm-hmm. That these statements have not been stronger, that the human rights violations have not been taken immediately, seriously enough to have real serious action in terms of sanctioning those responsible, even though the information of who is responsible and where and who is supporting them is available in Washington.
But it seems that this is a trend with the U.S. administrations, and I'm not only pointing at the Biden administration, because I remember when, for instance, Sisi had a coup on maybe one of the very few ever elected presidents in the Arab world. Again, lame condemnation and asking for clarifications, but then everything went very the way, I don't know, like for instance, Professor Assad Abu Khalil, and he's an American, I think, of Lebanese descent, and he wrote that he suspects that actually when Jeffrey Feltman was meeting the day before with members of the military junta, that maybe he was making it clear that, you know, we don't have any disagreement over what you're going to do, especially, and this is another thing we want to talk about, is that Sudan was put on the terror list for a while. Could you address that before I move to the question that I really want to talk about? But wasn't Sudan removed from the terror list a while ago? And why was it even put on that list?
The initial reason that it was put on the list in the 1990s was because Sudan at that time, under the leadership of the Islamist Hassan Turabi, the leader of the Islamist movement in Sudan, before he passed away in the 1990s, had organized or established an institution in Sudan itself that that hosted a variety of different Islamist extremist organizations, whether it's from Egypt, Iran, Pakistan, other places. I believe it was called the Arab and Islamic Conference. In addition to that, of course, in the 1990s, the Omar Bashir regime, the Islamist regime, had hosted Osama bin Laden personally. And then following that, there was, of course, the issue of the bombings of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. So all of that came together to put Sudan on, the United States put Sudan on the terrorist list, you know, the, or states that sponsor terrorism. There were, of course, other sanctions, not only the U.S., but also from the European Union as well. But the terrorist, of course, designation came from the United States. That was lifted under this partnership government with a deal that was made essentially with to normalize relationship with Israel. And so that was done informally. Of course, it wasn't, you know, the U.S. administration did not say we're lifting you because of this reason, but this was a, certainly a contributing factor to normalize relations with the country. In terms of did you want me to address
yeah,
that?
Yeah, exactly. Will the people of Sudan be approving of normalizing with the state of Israel?
I haven't done the survey, but it's unlikely under a democratic regime. For a variety of reasons, including the violation that Israel has against its people in Palestine and elsewhere. That was something that was supposed to be tabled for the period of elections under the civilian government. I can tell you, you know, the high-ranking senior Israeli officials have come out saying that they believe that Burhan would be a more reliable ally in terms of speeding with or going accelerating the normalization process. So that can tell you a great deal about, you know, what side Israel would be on. Would it be the military, which Burhan, who they're increasingly close to, or would it be an elected civilian government in Sudan? It's not likely that Sudanese would approve of normalization under these circumstances if there was, of course, a civilian government and free and fair elections. Remember, this government refused to establish a legislative assembly that was part of the constitutional declaration. The civilian leadership across the board said that this is not our decision, it's the decision of the Sudanese people, and we have to establish a parliament to discuss this and to vote on this. That, of course, was prevented from happening, mostly by General Burhan and the military leadership.
Let me remind our listeners, we have 10 minutes more to go, and if you have more questions, please send them to DJ. I'm going to read them to you, Professor, shortly. But we're talking to Professor Khaled Mustafa Midani, who is the chair of the African Studies Program at McGill University in Canada. He is also the author of Black Markets and Militias, or Militant militant informal networks in the Middle East and Africa. And I also want to ask you about it. But I received a very interesting question, Professor. Maybe it's going to take us a little bit away from the coup and what's going on in Sudan, but it is really timely. A listener is asking about global warming, if it's affecting Sudan in any aspect, especially that you have elaborated on the wealth, the agricultural wealth of Sudan. Is there any effects of global warming on Sudan?
Yes, there has been effects of global warming and climate change in Sudan and the whole Sahel region for decades, at least to the 1980s. I can tell your questionnaire that a contributing factor of the conflict in Darfur had to do with the desertification in that part, where in the context of the government intervening militarily, forced people in the Darfur area, villagers in particular, pastoralists and agro-pastoralists, to actually compete over scarce resources, increasingly scarce resources. The social contract between pastoralists and agro-pastoralists and farmers fell apart in the context, partly because of climate change, and that really becomes really important. In the case of Kordofan and the investments of the Gulf countries there, of course, there is the issue of depopulation of villagers, and not only taking their land, but also depopulation. And the kind of irrigation that's instituted and the technologies, of course, they're also problematic in a very, very delicate, Sahelian semi-arid region. And so this is why environmental activists in Sudan at the University of Khartoum and elsewhere have been really calling out these kind of investments that are very capital intensive, and at the same time not only undermine the livelihoods of farmers, and that's why there have been so many protests in the north in Sudan and Kordofan, for those of you who are interested, against these capital intensive agricultural projects, which is really important. There is the issue of the Nile waters, which of course Egypt is very concerned with. There's a lot of debate about that, but from the Sudanese perspective, experts in Sudan say that Egypt is using it as a strategic ploy, even though there is no imminent threat to the water resources for Egypt downstream.
Will Sudan be affected by the dam being built, the Renaissance Dam?
The Sudan will be affected by the Renaissance Dam much more than Egypt. Mm. These are experts in Sudan that I'm highlighting. People really there's a lot of misinformation, mostly because the powerhouses, of course, are Egypt and Ethiopia, and that's kind of the real geopolitical kind of conflict that you read in the headlines. But the Renaissance Dam, the waters themselves will affect Egypt a little bit south, not Sudan, not so much Egypt. And so the real protests and complaints have been coming from Sudanese experts in this. There is, and I could be corrected on this, but the danger of this particular dam affecting the resources, water resource of Egypt is something that we don't see coming. I think what Egypt is really concerned about, from my perspective, is renegotiating the Nile Waters agreement from the late 1950s. Now that renegotiation would affect Egypt's future, but there has no been there hasn't been a change in that agreement yet. I think that's Egypt's primary concern rather than the imminent threat of the dam in Ethiopia.
I have a very interesting question that takes us also away, but it is very timely, about COVID. Like, mm-hmm. with all these protests, with all the people in the streets, what are the COVID or corona levels in Sudan, and do you have the vaccination?
Well, at this point, the majority of Sudanese, of course, in the urban areas, some have the vaccinations, but the only vaccinations available to most, I believe, are the China vaccinations from China. And so they haven't been really distributed that much. So unfortunately, the vaccination rate is quite low. And that's just an additional danger in terms of what is going on in terms of the conflict in Sudan with these killings and the protests. Although, as you can see from the few images that come out that protesters and the leaders of the protests are, and in the hospitals as well, are trying very hard to at least comply with people wearing masks, even if they are not vaccinated.
And finally, Professor, I would like to ask you about black markets and militants' informal networks in the Middle East and Africa. What is your book about? We have like 4 minutes.
Sure. Well, thank you for mentioning the book. The book is about why young people in Egypt and Sudan join a militant organization. So there are a great deal of discussions. And I look at the political and economic factors that lead not to the leadership, but to the rank and file in Egypt who join the Muslim Brotherhood. And in the 1980s and 1990s, why some young Egyptian men join militant organizations. But I trace it to economic globalization, economic precarity, neoliberal policies combined to alter the kind of incentive structures for young men in particular. So I look at that in Egypt and Sudan. But in general, it is a book on economic globalization, the expansion of informal markets and the informal economy, where the majority of Sudanese and Egyptians and Somalis actually make their livelihood, and how that determines how the people in local communities in Egypt, Sudan, and Somalia, how that determines whether they join Islamist accommodation middle-class organizations like the Muslim Brotherhood or militant organizations, or in the case of Somalia, even ethnic-based and clan organizations. So you'll find for those interested in the region, in globalization, in Egypt, Sudan, and Somalia, you'll find hopefully chapters that will be of interest to you. I do want to conclude that the chapters on Egypt are about the Islamists in Sudan. And the reason I want to conclude with that is that what is not really apparent in the media following the violence of November 17th even is the fact that General Burhan is reconstituting the Islamist extremists that rule the National Congress Party and have dominated the Sudanese local economy through very corrupt means. So if you want a background on Burhan's allies and the political economy of Sudan and the Islamist domination of the country, of the economy in Sudan, and how that plays into current events in terms of General Burhan's calculations and this military coup, I think you'll find the chapters on Sudan informative. And of course, finally, we do want to tell people to consider the importance of Sudan's example of peaceful civil disobedience, wherein millions of young Sudanese and others, of course, are fighting against one of the most brutal authoritarian dictatorships that wants to reconstitute itself under the guise of somehow, forming a token civilian government, just as we've seen in other parts of the world. This civil disobedience will continue, and so attention to these protesters and the mobilization is key, because as you know, the Sudanese government has blocked, the generals have blocked all of the internet. There's a complete blackout, even in terms of land phones. And that, of course, means increasing more violence, human rights violations. And it's very important for the international community and Americans, whether they be in Florida or elsewhere, of course, to really pay attention and understand that these are heroic young people who are calling for a civilian democracy through peaceful forms of civil disobedience.
I really want to thank you, Professor Khaled Mustafa Midani, for being on True Talk. You have a lovely way of explaining a very tough situation in very simple terms. And I really want to thank you for being on True Talk. He's the author of Black Markets and Militants, Informal Networks in the Middle East and Africa. That book itself sounds fascinating. And he's also the chair of African Studies Program. Thank you so much, Professor. And I wish Sudan all the best.
Thank you. And all of you.
Thank you so much. This was Professor Mustafa Midani. I did have other questions, but he sounded... sorry, we ran out of time for this segment because of technology that I am using. My co-host is usually the one who is so good with technology, but thank God we have Frank and DT and Lamar and all these wonderful people supporting me. And it's been a while since I've been at the studios here. So good to be back to normal life. And there are so many things I would love to discuss. And if you have any questions about any previous shows, you can always call 813-239-9663. We didn't take many phone calls in the past couple of weeks, Ahmed and I. He's actually, by the way, traveling, but arriving today. 813-239-9663. And I wanted to play a music by a Sudanese lady. The Sudanese people have very interesting, they speak Arabic. They speak many languages, but they do also speak Arabic. And my Arabic is considered part of the Bilad al-Sham, like the greater Syria. If you are from Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, or Jordan, you have some similar accent and words, and we can understand each other very, very well. If you are from the Gulf, like the Emirates, or from Yemen, or from Bahrain and Qatar and Saudi Arabia, we can, of course, understand each other, and their language, their Arabic, is maybe even more classical and clear. But it's a different way of speaking. It's like Texas versus a Bostonian. And then if you are from Sudan and Egypt, then Sudan in particular is so different. And maybe you can notice now from the music that I will play. If you are from Libya or Tunisia or Algeria or Morocco, it is more difficult for me to understand because both Algeria and Tunisia and Morocco were occupied by the French and Libya by the Italian. So you can see where I am going with this. I'm just trying to give you an overview of language and how different it is. And you can see it in the music, and I really wanted to play it for the professor. But this is Huda. Her name is Huda, and she is singing in Sudanese accent.
والحب هذا
ولا هم هنا
سما شوفوا العيون دايبة غرام دايبة حنان دايبة منى.
If you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF 88.5 FM. And my brother was listening and he sent me a correction saying that I should say dialect. We have different dialects. So you were listening to Sudanese dialect. I've always wanted to be a DJ, like try to do a music show. Maybe today I should do that. So listen now to Tunisian music, for example. I'm not sure if you can tell the difference. They're both in Africa, Tunisia and Sudan. But can you tell if there is difference in the dialect? And this is True Talk on WMNF 88.5 FM, by the way. I think they are kind of similar, I noticed. So let me give you Ya Habibi from Asmahan. She is originally Syrian, but she lived in Lebanon and became very famous, she and her brother. And they really have amazing songs. And this is one of them called Ya Habibi Ta'ala, My Lover Come. And this was like in the 1930s. She's very famous, Asmahan. So you can notice, welcome back to True Talk. This is WMNF 88.5 FM. This is your host, Samar Jarrah, that usually talks politics, but I'm jealous of Stu. Every time I finish this show, I listen to him and I think, how can he do music for 3 hours? I'm looking at him, but obviously he can. So I'm trying to do like 5 minutes of being a DJ because I always like listen to WMNF. I'm fascinated by how different the music is. Depending on the different days. So you were listening to Asmahan. She was born in Syria. She's a princess or was a princess and then moved to Cairo and became very famous. And before it, I played a song from Tunisia and I know somebody called to find out what was the artist to do. So I have to go back. I'll try to find it and post it on Facebook. But now let's listen to music from Palestine. I'm not sure if you can tell the difference, but this is like typical Palestinian wedding song from Palestine. Now we go to Iraq and listen to a music to Iraq, from Iraq, and let's see if you can notice a difference in the dialect. Also in the style of music. I hope you enjoyed my selection of Arabic music. We went all the way from Sudan to Tunisia to Egypt to Palestine to Iraq. And I hope you noticed the differences in music, in style, in dialect, in accent, in everything. And thank you for supporting WMNF and thank you for supporting True Talk. And next week, inshallah, is Thanksgiving. I wish you all the best, and drive safely and eat lots of turkey. This is WMNF Tampa. NPR News is next.